Welcome to the Galen Trombley Show. Be sure to subscribe, review, and share the episode. You can follow me on social media at Galen Trombley. I hope you enjoy the show.
Greetings. Please hold for a very important message.
Lightspeed sequence initiated.
How may I help you?
Bonjour.
Security breach.
The truth shall set you free. Awesome. It's a miracle.
Stabilizing. 3, 2, 1. Mission complete.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Welcome, everybody. This is episode 262 of the Galen Trombley Show. My guest today, you're actually joining partway through our conversation because he's been here for about almost an hour now, which is great. We had a whole, I wish it was actually recording with what we just talked about. But Randy Giltz, he is, let me just make sure I get all the titles right, Senior Vice President at Northern Insuring. Randy, I'm going to have you give all the background, but obviously a family business. It's been, I would say... I had Dina on. I know it's a fourth generation. I know this has been going on for many years, well before you joined. So it has been a long-standing North Country business, four generations, which I think is unheard of, really. It's a very, very, very low percentage that actually make it to that level, which is very commendable. And I think, I'm sure that has a lot to do with what we'll probably talk about. Randy, thank you for coming on, and we hit the record button. So for people that do not know you, give us a little background. Who are you? How'd you get here?
Started out in the insurance industry with my father helping me get a job after college at Plattsburgh State working in Syracuse. So started down in Syracuse, New York as a underwriter trainee. And the idea was to get to the role of underwriter and then come back and work in the family business after a short period of time. So I started on Black Monday, October 1987. And if anybody understands the stock market, that was a 500-point loss in 1987. So it was basically 25% of the market capitalization that day. So a lot of people lost their jobs. I obviously didn't. I stayed around and learned my stripes from insurance company side and got to get out of Plattsburgh for a while, which was really good to understand if I wanted to live here. Mm-hmm. It made me make some good choices and, you know, and understanding more about, you know, what was going on outside the area.
Did you go to PHS?
No, I went to Peru High School.
Peru, okay. So, yeah. So when you say Valcor, you grew up on the south side of Plattsburgh?
Correct.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. That makes sense. So you went to Peru, you ended up going to St. Lawrence in Plattsburgh State, right?
Yes.
Both colleges. Yep. Your grandfather started the business, correct?
No, actually, he came in a little bit after it started. He was a math teacher during the Great Depression in Aux-Sable Forks. And business started in Aux-Sable Forks to provide comprehensive and collision auto insurance for people that needed to buy autos. And we started in Aux-Sable Forks and in Glens Falls, New York.
So I do remember the Aux-Sable roots. So that your grandfather was from Aux-Sable at the time?
Actually, he lived there as a teacher in the school district teaching math.
So, and then your father got in?
Correct, after college. After he would work at Land of Make-Believe, icon of...
theme park?
Yeah, theme park, you know, down in Jay, New York, putting bumper stickers on and working in the parking lot. And I think he was making a little more money doing that than when he first started working at Northern Insuring way back in the day. So my dad went to St. Lawrence, and he skied in college for a while and had a really good time, graduated with a chemistry degree. And then he was, it was time for him to, go out and do something else.
So what level of influence did he have on you getting in? Was it something like, pretty strong, like I want to do the family business?
Oh, very, very much so.
Okay.
Growing up, you know, it was more like, yeah, you're going to go in family business. You know, it's something that was going to be offered. In fact, you know, it was basically what I thought I was going to do all along. Mm-hmm. I didn't have another idea specifically to go and do anything else. And went to school for business management and, you know, started with economics, ended up with business management and, you know, started to go toward, you know, insurance because we interviewed that way. Grew up with it, mm-hmm. felt like, you know, this was the best offer I could have. It was a really good option. did an interview with another insurance company, but this one seemed like a, you know, a good way to go and then come back in the family business.
Now, regarding, because like you said, you moved away. So St. Lawrence is a little bit out, but still North Country. But then you went out toward the Syracuse area. Was the goal to try to move away or at least kind of feel it out a bit?
Well, I was one of those kids in college that really didn't have a lot of drive. So I kind of, you know, made my way through college and had a good time.
Yep.
And then now it's time to get a job. So now this seems like a good place to go see what else is going on and learn a little bit. So I was one of those.
Reality hit a little bit?
Sure.
So. But it was like, hey, I want to go kind of, you know, while I'm young, kind of run around, get a little perspective and then come back.
Yeah. And I mean, at one point I wasn't sure I would completely do that, but that was certainly, you know, it's been a good ride. I've been here ever since back in 1990. So thought about moving somewhere else for a little while. Do I want to go, you know, to Seattle? But it really never was something taken, you know, I took too seriously and was able to come back here and help out the family firm at first with my skills. And then, you know, I've taken on different roles since.
How long has, like, your current location right now in Margaret Street, how long have you guys been there?
1981.
Okay, so I wasn't sure because, again, that's the only place I've ever known. I didn't know if it was, so 81, that's been, I mean, obviously you did the facelift a few years ago, like, you know, kind of did a capital project on it. But, okay, so same location. So when you came back, did you start off as, like, what was your role when you came in?
I came out as what we call a marketer. I deal not your traditional marketing role. You deal with, like, for marketing, you know, sales from people from advertising, but dealing with an insurance company and helping negotiate terms, conditions, rates for dealing on small business.
Okay.
So to help out, you know, on a business side, and I would work with various insurance companies because I knew the language as an underwriter. I could commonly understand what they were dealing with, and it was more an introduction to dealing with salespeople, agents, you know, selling insurance and working through with them and trying to help them.
So you were negotiating between agents or clients in the insurance company?
Well, we negotiate for best possible terms for a client.
On the client, okay.
Yeah, for using an application, you know, it was filled out based on all the different lines of insurance. So that was my role day in and day out when I came back. That's what I did all the time.
So, like, right now, is that like a common entry level position for someone in insurance?
Yeah, it could, but, you know, producer can be a common entry level position too, or, you know, salesperson or staff assistant. Mm-hmm. I mean, Colin started similarly in that type role that I did. There was a job opening and he came in and, you know, has been doing that and he's actually elevated his role. So it's a good start because you can learn a lot.
Yeah,
you can really get to see a lot of different people, and you have the ability to not just connect with a person on the street. You've got the ability to also understand what the insurance company is trying to say too, and understand where they're coming from.
Well, I think I look at like real estate and insurance. There's some similarities between the two. And when I came in the business, same thing. I just sales agent, worked with a lot of buyers, didn't work with any sellers, very, very new to it. I think there's two levels. Number one, I was able to, I grew an understanding, and a lot of it was just trial and error and trying to figure out what worked and, you know, what sticked and kind of what I liked doing and how I kind of operated. But I saw a lot, I experienced a lot. And what it also gives me now is, you know, now that I'm on the other side, we're a little more experienced, but I'm like, people are coming on, you're trying to train the new agents, you have a level, I understand the struggles, I understand what they're probably going through, I understand what they're, because a lot of it's just confidence, like a lot of it's like, man, like this is tough, I'm like, it is, like, but, you know, you can do it, like, this is what you got to do, and like, set the realistic expectation. But I find a lot of it is like, it allows me to connect more, and I think when you start out with, and this is any business, I think if you start out that low, I say low level, but that entry level, where you get to learn everything, because then you start building up. Because like I said, if you just got popped into something that you were 2-3 levels above someone on the entry level, you might not be able to relate to them as much because you're, you know, so you still have a lot of those, like, you know, even though it's been a few decades, you're still like, I still remember those calls. I still remember, like, grinding away on stuff and hitting the phones and whatever that might look like in insurance. That's true?
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
It's people business.
Yeah.
You're still talking to people behind all the machines and all the inner workings and all that. It still is something that you need to make relationships with. You need to work through situations. You need to still go back to the core level things that make sense. And sometimes you're there completely talking, trying to talk people out of things that don't make sense on mm-hmm. insurance company side. And the other side, you know, is a reverse. So, you know, right now we're dealing with what is not a really good insurance market. So we're dealing with trying to talk insurance companies down and try to work with them differently. So that's some of the things that go on, you know, just like the real estate market you're talking and I earlier. So it changes.
So if premiums get like too bloated, people would just opt out of not getting insurance.
Well, that's what's happening right now. Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, it happens some on, you know, health insurance too, where, you know, there's an affordability. And I mean, this is not an unknown thing, but when you look at, you know, personal auto insurance right now is driving inflation at the beginning of the year. That's not a real good thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, when you're now it's not us causing, but it's not a good thing to be in that position, you know.
Like insurance, in how many scenarios is insurance required to get?
Well, you have automobile for state statutory rules. Okay.
So, I was going to say, if you have any type, like I know in real estate, if you have a mortgage, you're required to get insurance. So same thing if you have an auto policy.
State law.
Okay.
Workers' comp.
Okay.
State law in New York. Not every state. Disability insurance for New York State. That's law for business.
Okay.
And then, like you said, though, mortgage requirement. Okay. Contract requirements, typically, mm-hmm. you know, required for insurance. So after that, you have, you know, your choices, typically. It could be you want to do business with somebody, which is your contract issue, and you have to.
Yep.
And then you have to meet those terms. All right. So, and those are things that, you know, in some kinds, it's just like where you're the 1099 employee, you're going to have to do that, which is more on your contract.
Mm-hmm.
Similar issue. So, the state law issue typically is the one that goes down. That's the most basic. After that, it becomes, you know, sustainability, business wants to function, you know. Do I have enough value here so I can start tomorrow? Can I afford it? So,
what's the biggest driver in like the ebbs and flows of insurance?
A capital content and supply and demand issues typically drive it. So you have right now, last year and 2023 was a huge natural disaster year. Not in Plattsburgh.
Yeah.
You know, if you look over in south and toward Montpelier where they had a big flood, out in the Midwest.
Yep.
So you have in California and some of those issues. So money that interest rates typically more, it's easier to put more money at a 6% interest rate right now
mm-hmm.
than to put in something speculative like insurance that might have hurricane driven risk behind it. So, and then you add that all up, it doesn't create a really good, you know, scenario. It's not going to last forever.
Mm-hmm.
But right now that's kind of, it's topping out and, you know, kind of needs to change. We're fortunate that we're in the Northeast.
Yeah.
We're not, you know, Southern California or, you know, Florida or actually Louisiana.
Yeah.
Or Texas even. So.
Well, you take like, so like Montpelier, like if all those people start claiming insurance and damages and everything like that, does that affect the national companies? Does that affect someone like you? Does that like, who does, where's, I guess, the trickle down of what that would end up causing?
Both ways.
Okay.
Okay. So,
and obviously the premium on the people eventually, right? The policy would go up?
Yes. Well, insurance companies all buy, typically, mm-hmm. buy some level of reinsurance. That's a capital issue. So if you don't have capital, people want to put their money somewhere else because it's safer in interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so now I don't have as much money in that bucket to use. Okay. So now there's a lot more claims going on. So, and now this number of reinsurance companies are less. So there's less players. The rates are driven higher. And also I could tell you too, I mean, stuff in Montpelier, they're small enough so it doesn't matter. And a lot of that might not be covered because it was flood.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a conflagration of everything, including inflation on values of homes.
Yeah.
Where you have all that and cars. I mean, I think if anybody's had to deal with trying to get a car repaired, we've got just like everything, lost supply and demand. There could be, you know, less people potentially doing that now. So that all adds up to kind of a, you know, worst case scenario at the moment
mm-hmm.
for lots of things. And then, you know, the value of lumber and products don't go down as fast as they go up.
Yeah.
So all that kind of doesn't create a great scenario. So nationally, national insurance companies, you still have to pay for stuff that goes on in California here to some extent.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's capital and what money's available.
Well, like I don't like real estate. It all, if you had to pick like the max, it's always supply and demand's the big one. And there's other factors. Like when the interest rates went up, The only thing it did is it slowed the market down, but it didn't do anything to the prices. We had a dip in prices for about 4 months maybe.
Yeah.
That was very, very, very slight, maybe 5,000 on the average. And then what happened is it just picked right back up because of supply and demand. Basically, the lack of supply outpaced the increase in an interest rate. So we never really saw the there's not as many homes on the market, and that's the bigger yeah. issue, but it's not necessarily the interest rates. The interest rates added to it a little bit, but really the only time it ever hit was when they were really volatile, that everybody was a little bit more gun-shy because, like, I don't know how wild this is going to get. And once everything's kind of regulated and stabilized a bit, buyers just came right back into the market, and you just saw the homes start to get bought up again. And so I was just kind of wondering, because ours is definitely – that's kind of it.
One of the other things that's going on in personal insurance nationally, too, is there's a lot more driver problems, not to do with alcohol. They're not to do with distracted driving.
Like texting and stuff?
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's far worse than it used to be. So you have that. Everything costs more, and so it's a combination of everything.
Yeah.
And so that doesn't help. So last year, I think insurance companies lost 10 cents on the dollar.
Wow.
Nationally. Yeah. So that's the hardest part of it. So right now, so every consumer is dealing with that right now.
So, I guess insurance companies, they build up kind of a nest egg, weather the storm, and then they, you know, it's just the evidence. You kind of like make hay when the rain's shining, or however that term is.
You got it. Make hay when the sun's shining.
Sun shining there.
Yes.
You go. Yeah.
But you're right, Jalen. Yeah. It's just that. And so, they have to have capital to pay claims, and they're obviously for-profit business are typically trying to make money.
Mm-hmm.
True. And then, you know, so yes, they're trying to protect their bottom line. So, you know, that's a fair statement. And the other end too is when you look at what you want insurance for, you typically want it. What else is it good for? Otherwise, it's just an expense. You want it to pay your claims.
Mm-hmm.
So I heard a story yesterday from somebody we're talking to, like, hey, how come you're so tight about this and you're not doing this? And how come you can't help us with that? Well, my mother couldn't, you know, her insurance company went belly up mm-hmm. at one point. New York State is considered fairly regulated for insurance, but it does a good job for that reason, protecting what goes on in the state versus somewhere like Florida, where you don't have insurance companies that typically want to be there because they have hurricane prone areas and they, you know, it's tough to make money. And so there's this kind of balance that we need. We need it to work both ways. We need it to work for the consumer, and we need to work for the insurance company so that you can do well. You've got a great driving record. You're going to do well. And then, you know, to some extent, you're going to have to pay more if you had some claims, fortunately. But if we can strike that balance and keep some of the politicians away,
mm-hmm.
because the national flood plan is basically underwater for a lot of ways because politicians kept favoring it one way or the other, we're going to try to strike that balance. It's not going to work for everybody. And yet when we do strike it well, then it's better.
Nice. Yeah.
It's as good as it can be. We're not there right at the moment because of some of the stuff that we can't control at the moment.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I was going to say, it's when you start dealing with regulations. I mean, we were talking before, we won't repeat everything, or go back into the full time, but you know, the thing they just came out with real estate and how that's, you know, as of right now, that adds in, I don't think anything really with, I'll give the Cliff Notes version. I don't think anything with teeth right now, but I do think it's going to, in the short term, I've already had multiple conversations and been on calls. It almost feels like COVID again. Remember when they were changing stuff in COVID, like every other day, and you would tell your office and I'd tell the agents like, okay, this is first I got to figure it out. Then I tell everybody. And then 48 hours, it's a totally different rule. And then they're like, hey, remember what I said Monday? Scratch that. It's now Wednesday. We have a new ruling. And I'm sure you guys were the same. That happened for probably 3-4 weeks of just like, I felt like I was just being hypocritical to what I was saying before. I feel like today was the first, yesterday and today were like the first days I've experienced that since COVID, which was like something nationally that came out. And then now you're like, all right, well, I got to talk to people. I got to kind of try to figure it out quickly. So I have, you know, I would say ammunition, but talking points that I can actually explain. But then you got to talk about it. So like same thing, like it's an industry that's regulated and we don't have full control, we're at the mercy of, unfortunately, higher ups that make decisions, and that we have to be adaptable and change and, look for opportunity or try to hedge against negative stuff. But it definitely causes, it's like, again, you're in a small business. it's like an extra thing to add on where it's like, oh God, we have all these other things we have to do. And now let's throw that on. And maybe that becomes a little bit more urgent, you know, in the hierarchy of things you're working on. But then the same token, it's like, oh God, now that's going to take up how many hours or weeks of additional effort.
It's a very regulated industry, insurance. Yeah. Now, real estate, like we were talking earlier with some of the changes and what the National Realty Board came out with and the judgment call. What we talked about here locally is you don't see how that can really affect here locally. We have little influence on the national market and what we're doing up here.
We'll be influenced more from whatever comes from the headlines of that.
Right.
Which, and unfortunately, and again, the couple articles I've seen, I was telling Randy before we came in the air, like if I could have had a marker and could circle all the things that I thought were maybe not fully the truth or partial truth or leading a little bit, I wish I could, because and people are doing this, brokers across the country are basically like calling out a lot of the, I guess, the headlines and saying, wait, there's more to this and what they're, you know, what they're saying. And I think the issue is, though, when something comes out and it's not really told, it just kind of comes out, and then you're just like, we're left to kind of pick up the pieces and tell people exactly what our version of it is, even though our version means nothing, because you know, I'm not the one making the rules at, you know, at the national level. But it's I will say, like you had mentioned, though, the North Country on a few things economically, it's not, we don't see the massive ebbs and flows.
Yes.
You know, which is, you know, in our business when we had the market tanked in 07-08, our market went down, but not nearly as bad as, you know, Florida, Vegas, California, these other places. And when you see like COVID numbers going up, like our numbers went up, but it was we play in a very kind of like muted spectrum of ups and flows. Like it very, very much it does, but it's much smaller than what you'd see on a national scale. On your end, is it the same way?
It is and it isn't. I know what you're talking about. And from our standpoint, auto insurance, not that everybody wants to pay more money, it's as low a cost in Clinton County as it is anywhere in New York State. Mm-hmm. And it's low from, I think, a commercial truck standpoint from dealing anywhere just about in the U.S. We don't have a higher theft area. We don't have a higher crime area. We don't have, you know, higher driving accident. We don't have a court system here that reflects it. So, and then when you deal with a liability, the similar situation depends on courts, settlement judgment, living costs, and things like that are different everywhere. And judgments are based on some of that.
Well, you also said too, weather, like we're lucky because we don't get a lot of natural disasters.
Correct.
So does that help policies here?
Very much so. Okay. Yeah. And, you know, when we're 300 miles from the coast, we're typically not in the middle of that area where you're going to be dealing with a windstorm deductible like you would down on Long Island or the coast. And, you know, where they're models and they put all math models out about trying to figure out when's the next storm. And, you know, we've gotten so generated with, you know,
like
data.
Like 100-year storm kind of thing?
Oh, and there can be 200-year storms within 2 years. So you have to be careful how you read that. So that is all very true. You know, when we're talking with people like, hey, by the way, we're talking to a rep out of Florida today. By the way, we're 300 miles from the coast. Just don't forget who we are. You know, where we are.
Do you, because we run into this a little bit with like flood insurance. There's some places that need flood insurance, and we've had, areas where you can kind of fight it by getting an elevation survey done. But but then you look at it, and, you know, I've seen some people have insurance, because a lot of it was like, what, 2011? Was Irene, right? That had like the flooding in downtown and stuff. And I remember when that happened, which was very trippy because you don't see the water come up that high. But when you saw it, and again, that's, I've never seen it that high. I'm sure people well farther down in age wise than me have probably said the same thing. And but you look at that as houses were affected from that for years after, and we're still like some houses, because they haven't sold or done anything since, still are holding flood insurance. But some of it's laughable because of the elevation. I'm like, this would never flood. Like I saw a couple that were so high up on the bank, but because they technically had water frontage. I'm like, so I guess speaking to that, do you run into that a lot?
No. Well, most of the time, the people that buy flood insurance that need it typically don't have it when it's a problem. So only 13% of people have flood insurance at that. So it's rare. Plus the system itself is trying to be revamped multiple times. Elevation certificates aren't always needed now.
Okay.
They, you know, grandfathered things in. And, you know, so if you were in that situation where you were looking at whether there was a 100-year or 500-year flood, they've remapped and rezoned numerous areas in your local community. So when we run into this situation, it's not often. So from your standpoint, it's like a worst-case scenario. From a real estate standpoint, you have all of a sudden have that to deal with, and a consumer might not want to buy if they have to deal with some really crazy flood insurance total.
Yeah.
It can make it harder. So,
and that comes, and not often, but that does come up. And, you know, and sometimes it's deal breakers. So, like, I don't want to, again, I'm just putting numbers out there, but you know, you could probably be paying $3,000 a year in some spots extra.
And there is more insurance companies that will try to play in that area, but they're only going to play in areas that's not considered a high flood zone.
Yeah.
The private insurance market, they've tried to enter that in because the politicians got involved for so many years. They helped their constituents. And it's $20 billion underwater, the National Flood Plan that I last heard. So it's difficult to try to understand it as a consumer. So, yeah, you just don't want to go in without looking at this in advance for a deal if you can help it.
Now, Randy, regarding family business, how? Because I'm Kavanaugh, second generation. You guys are fourth generation. Obviously, your sister's involved, your nephew's involved, your dad still...
Yeah, he's still...
I know he's still around. I know still doing it. So regarding that, like, how is it working day to day? How is it... you've been around insurance your entire life, so even just conversations with your dad, maybe conversations with Colin, any of your kids in insurance?
No.
Okay, because I read a little bit about the kids, and I'm like, I don't think any of them said insurance, so... You know, nephew, sister, father, like how's that working as like a multiple generational thing?
You know, so we're 35, 36 people. I think we just hired someone today. So we have defined job roles and responsibilities. We have respect. You work in different jobs. Like Dina is my boss. She's CEO. Colin, who I work with, I work with a similar department in marketing, but it's not my direct report. And my father is still chair of the board, but he's pulled back some because, you know, his age too. And so, you know, it was just time, I think, for him. My mom's also in a nursing home here. So that was, you know, certainly, you know, important for him.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think from our standpoint, it is, do you get along? Do you get along to holiday time? And you want to be able to continue to be friends and social and, you know each other. And then, because there's some difficult conversations that happen every once in a while. So you need to be able to operate from a respect standpoint. You need to operate from a standpoint of authority and, you know, who makes the end calls and decisions. I think those are, the ways that it's worked and the way it's gone. And I think the way it's been successful. And again, you want to be happy and be successful. You have to keep... you know, getting along with each other. And, you know, to an extent, too, you have to find a way through things that aren't always easy.
Yeah.
Here we are, what, 94 years? Okay.
Yeah.
When we get to 2030, in June 20th, it'll be 100. So we're that far along, and that's the goal is to keep the business going and keep it sustainable. As you look at businesses get bought and sold, the goal is to keep it independent. And to be independent means also you need to be independent, successful, and work at it. So we all work at it, and they all put time in. You know, there's no free ride.
Well,
so,
and I'll come back to a couple of things. I just looked up the stat because you said almost 100 years.
Yep.
U.S. Census Bureau, it says the reports that only 12% of companies are older than 26 years old. 0.5%, so 0.5% of all companies make it to 100 years. So that's what, one out of every 200 businesses make it to 100 years. So, you're kind of in a rarefied air there, you know, and I was wondering how many local companies even in Clinton County have made it to 100 years. So there's only,
I don't know.
Probably a couple, but not a whole lot. So, because I always look at, when you look at family businesses, you have the, you know, you obviously have the personal side and you have the business side, and both sides carry emotion, both sides can carry tempers, both sides can carry strong opinions, but it's again trying to have that balance of, you know, separating, you know sister, coworker, father, coworker, and you know, I think it's not an easy thing to do. So the fact that however, and again, I'm sure there's better days, or, you know, there's bad days, there's good days, but overall, it's like you're trending. You still have gone through so many decades of it. Like, it's almost like it's a hard thing to do, and to be able to say, hey, we're almost to 100 years and have been doing it. I mean, that's the tip of the cap to everybody involved, because even if I'm sure behind the scenes, you could say like, man, there's a couple times it got pretty heated, but we saw our way through it.
Well, you have to have good people too.
Yeah.
You know, I think without that doesn't matter. I mean, you know, without the rest of the family and everybody else doing what we're doing, I mean, you've got good people that you're friendly with and you know and you like. So that goes without saying. I mean, that all of that counts, and it all matters. I mean, it does every day when you punch the clock or however you work with it. Mm-hmm. And whether, you know, you look at, you know, whether you wanted to go in the business or not when you grew up, and, you know, Colin's in the business now. I mean, mm-hmm. he's doing great, you know, I think, and that's our future. You know, so we're, you know, it's doing well. He's you know, hey, things are going good.
He was similar to you though, because he lived in Portland for a bit and then came back. So it's kind of like got away, came back, and
yeah.
And I think a lot of, I think the North Country, I've said it a lot too. Like there's benefits, there's negatives, and there's good things, pros and cons. I would say the one thing that people typically always come back to is just people around here. Because you could look at whether it's coworkers, whether it's clients, whether it's, you know, just how, like we talked about before with real estate. I said locally, real estate is a pretty respectful group of people locally. If you go on the national scale, that is very cutthroat. But I would say locally, there's a lot of good collaboration amongst brokerages, amongst agents. I mean, we have our fights and our, you know, our little tiffs here and there. But overall, like, you still see them and you still, like, I dropped my kid off today with, in my kid's preschool class, there's two people that have ties to real estate that I know. And I'm like, you know, one of the kids is like, hey, you playing basketball? He's like, yeah. I said, you beating your dad yet? Because his dad's in real estate. And he's like, not yet. So he's just got to run faster. He's slow. Like, you know, you can bust on. But they're like, yeah. They're people that you know. And it's like, you see their kids and they play on the same team. It's just a small-knit community. So I find that that's a good thing, that people go away. And I think, and I had this conversation on, who was I talking? Oh, Steve Frederick. Mm-hmm. About people that go away and they come back. And I said, sometimes people look at it as a negative to come back. And I think that the opposite should be look like, hey, you went and, like, let's say Colin goes to Portland, bigger city, gets a level of experience out there or exposure to whatever it is. It's bigger than here. Can now bring back whatever he learned there, bring it back here. And hopefully he's better for it. And the North Country is better for it. And I think anybody that comes back, or same with you.
Like, we all did that.
Yeah.
Dina did too. She worked in claims in the Fort Worth area, Texas. So,
oh, yeah. Okay.
So she had that background too. My father only did ROTC in the Army for a while. So not exactly, but, you know, working at Land of Maple Leaf, I guess, didn't cut it. But, you know, maybe different time and era. But I think it's important to not just presume your path, and then, you know, when you're also a little bit older, you're making active decisions, and that worked for me. I mean, some people that lived around here the whole life, it's been great for them. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not a choice I thought about a lot growing up, but I think I embraced it when I moved away, and then made the active decision, decided to move back. And I think Colin too, you know, when the time was right for him, I think he decided that. And Dina also, deciding whether to start a family, and with Mark, and, you know, I think that was, you know, an opportunity, talking to my father, and, you know, to come back and work in the family business. And she certainly has done, you know, extremely well and thrived ever since. So, you know, so I think for us, with a family business, and, you know, the most important thing though is, you need to get along when you leave the office at the end of the day. That's more important than anything else. Because after that, I mean, you know, it's not worth it, right?
Yeah. And well, that's the thing. I was saying a little bit before we started, too, is like when you look at just business in general, and especially me, like when I started having kids, like my things that were more important to me changed. My priorities changed. Mm-hmm. Things changed. I worked differently. I structure things differently. I've left a ton of opportunities on the table because they didn't want to sacrifice stuff with the kids. And, you know, and I think that, you know, I look at that kind of stuff as like that, to me, that's important. And I think as I go along, I'm hopefully, you know, that's just something I never wanted to have a regret. So I think it's the same thing when you said, like, listen, we might've left some opportunity. Maybe we didn't execute on something or this or that, but I can still go to the birthday party or the family or the wedding or whatever. And they're like, because I think at the end of the day, like, business, whether it goes 100 years or doesn't go 100 years, like, that's irrelevant. It's kind of the relationships and the, like, even the internal legacy you have amongst the family. you know, they want to know, like, Uncle Randy was a good guy, not, you know.
The best part is it's a people business.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, I mean, every day we work, we've got to do everything. You know, we got to get everything ready. We've got to get all the information organized. We got to make sure we present well. But talking to people, what this business is about, relationships matter. Mm-hmm. They're where this, you know, works differently than if you're standing behind a transactional piece of work.
Yeah.
When you get to go out and talk to people, see how their business runs, see how they're doing, see how people work, see how they're doing around in Clinton County. Those are the parts that make the business fun.
You also, you typically have long-term relationships with people too.
Correct.
Whether they're renewing or doing something like that. So it's like, hey, you know, I'm sure there's people that you have insured since you got into business that are, they're still in it, or the family's still in it, and you still know them and they're still alive and still, you know, it's kind of like, hey, I've got this 30-year relationship with clients, which is cool to see, because not every business, even our business, isn't like that. Sometimes I sell a home to somebody and they like, hey, we're going to be here for 30 years. I'm like, well, I'll probably be hopefully done by the time you look to sell. So I may never work with them again. So, okay. And my last question, just because one of time, but I also want to get into some of your other hobby things here. You put down that.
Sure.
Regarding, so when you started back in, you know, January 1st of 1990 with Northern, between then and now, what has been, that you think, the biggest change, or, you know, with yourself or with the company in general, like just over that time frame?
Good question. Okay. I think the ability to explain what we're doing and to do it more effectively in a simplistic way is more and more and more important right now than it was even 30, 35 years ago. We're respected, and we're expected, though, to be able to do something at a level that's supposed to be, you know, real simple. Mm-hmm. And I think that way to talk has become a requirement, not just passive. You have to be able to do it, and you have to be able to effectively do it with all the machines and all the tools and all the other systems in the way, or whatever else comes on. And I think that's the thing that, and I don't think it's going to stop. You look at AI coming on right now, mm-hmm. and I think there's more to that than we said, because people are going to be able to utilize that, you know. And so we have to find a way to figure out and how to talk to people constantly based on the new environments and the new changes that are going on, as simplistically and effectively as we can. So I'm not saying it wasn't easy or harder back then, but I think it's, to me, it's constantly the way that we see evolve is that. So we say, it's simplify the complicated. It's been our motto in the past. So that's what we continue to
do. You said that really well, Randy, because I've never actually, I agree 100%, and I never really thought of it like that. Because the world is just quicker now. So we have to be, like you said, faster, simplified, and I would say, I want to say maybe more correct. I don't, it's a weird way of saying it, but you got to be like on, you got to have understanding better now than you probably, because you don't have as much time to react. Also, people nowadays expect things quicker than they did 10 years ago. Well, I mean, I've been in for 15 years. 15 years ago, things didn't move as fast as they do now, and which is a good and a bad thing, but yeah, I would agree. I like the way you said that, because I never thought of it like that. But yeah. Okay. So you move back. I noticed most of the stuff you put here, I knew some of these things, but most of the stuff, you're an outdoor guy.
Yes.
How in a is that like, you have the work, you have family, you have responsibilities in life. Is like just getting outside and doing your own thing, is that like your reprieve?
Yes.
So what is, on a given, if I could say right now, Randy, instead of being on this podcast, which we're glad you're on, if you could pick anything else, what would you rather be doing right now?
At this time of year?
Yeah.
Today? Oh, I'd be skiing.
Skiing. Downhill?
Or if there was snow, I'd go cross country.
Do you have a preference on either one?
Either or, depends on the day, depends on the wind, okay. Depends on where I could go, depends on how far I have to travel, depends on how much time I have. Or I'd snowshoe, or if there was actually ice on the lake anymore, I'd go skating on the lake. Because that would be fun. Like skating to Vermont and back is, you know.
Have you done that before?
Sure.
Really?
So, from Cumberland Head. So.
Wow.
Yeah, but we haven't had ice like that in a long time.
I've never actually thought of that. I've seen people on snowmobiles going. I'm like, no way I'm getting a snowmobile.
Yeah, it's a little crazy. But yeah, 2 miles there and back from Cumberland Head. Sure.
Have you always been an outdoors guy?
Yeah, well, we got brought up to ski with my parents at Whiteface when we were kids. So we were introduced that, and I used to go hunting with my father, bird hunting, when I was a kid. So those kind of things were what I was introduced to. Plus, my dad really liked to be outside, whether it was golf or tennis, and, you know, whether it was playing ball. I mean, when we were kids, it was always something, you know, when we were outside. So, yeah, I mean, I think it's been part of me since I was very young, and fresh air has always been great. And I like every season. Doesn't matter which one. I just don't like it when it's not good and I can't do something in it. So,
what, so was it, I mean, did that weigh on your decision to come back to?
Oh, the outdoors and where we have so much to offer here, yeah, fits the bill right for me. I'm not a city person necessarily.
Have you ever... I mean, since you were a kid till now, have you ever, like, lost the love of the outdoors? Was there ever a part where you're like, I just kind of gave up skiing and, like,
a little bit in college,
skating and all that?
When I was having a lot more fun, just socializing and partying a little bit. But, you know, I still skied and, you know, I would lift weights or do something like that. But no, I think the older I've gotten, the more I've spent more time doing more things outside. Particularly, I have an inside job where I'm in the car most of the time. So the escape is to be able to get outside in the fresh air and listen. And try to do anything possible. We have a great lake, fortunate enough to be able to utilize it, and use it a lot. I mean, I think anything that I can do to enjoy, you know, what we have out here is right up my alley.
And I'm assuming, because again, you appear to be in good shape. So fitness has always been something you've tried to stay up on in health?
More so now than ever. I mean, after you deal a little bit of back issues and spinal stenosis, stretching is really important. Plus, I think it's for my mental health. I half the reason I do it. If you're sitting in front of a computer a lot, talking a lot, I need to have a release and do something. And because of my knees and some injuries, I can't really do competitive sports. So I have to do something like I'll swim tomorrow morning.
So every day you're doing something?
More or less.
Yeah.
Yeah. If it's not stretching or something, or I'll go for walks on the weekend with my wife, Julia, or the dog.
Yeah.
Or, for instance, you know, in the summertime, it's everything from paddleboarding to kayaking to biking to golfing.
Have you always been in shape? Relatively the average person out there?
More or less. Yeah. I always try to take advantage of whatever something to do. But more so now. I exercise more than I did when I was even younger.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I'm trying to, you know, I've gone through spurts. Like, I'm really good exercising. You kind of fall off and you come back in. And I'm trying, like, right now I'm back in it and I'm trying to really maintain it. Partly because I found, like, you probably speak to this. When you have, like, little kids, they move. And my thing was, I'm like, I just want to be able to hang. Like, I'm not at the point now. I'm not competitive in anything. Like, I like the golf, I like the ski, and I try to work out, and I try to eat well, and I try to do the stuff to maintain longevity because I want to keep up with my kids. And I don't want, like, for me personally, I look at it, one, there's the mental aspect of it. Like, if I work out, I'm mentally a little more sharper, I have better mood, you get all the endorphin stuff. But to me, it's like I want to be able to be there for my kids long-term and day-to-day. Like, so that's, like, I know this, and I think at my age, that is now become more, which is funny because I don't feel old, but I do feel old in a way. Like, it hurts to get out of bed some days, and, you know, and I know when I'm working out and eating well, even though someone may say, hey, you're still pretty young, I still feel the effects of it. So to me, it's like I'm looking at it now of, like, I want to set a good base, and I want to be a good example to the kids too.
Full credit to my wife, Julia, who moved to the area. I met her, and she's an exercise specialist. A lot of my good eating habits are from her. A lot of my good cardio habits are from her. When we were much younger, when the kids were first born, we had a triple jog stroller.
Oh,
we pushed the kids around in running. In fact, actually ran in a race or two with a triple jog stroller, pushing the kids with the dog.
What's the age gaps of the kids?
My kids are 2 years and 3 months, and I have twins. So, or wow, we have twins.
Three under three.
Yes, correct.
I was going to ask, did any of them twins? Wow, that's...
Yeah, so fraternal twins.
Wow.
So,
yeah.
But you're right, Galen. When I was much younger and dealing with the kids who were much younger, my life and exercise was a lot different. It's actually just a big blur. I can't even remember hardly any of it. I think I ran then, so that's what you do. We had the jog stroller. Yeah. We had a triple, a double, and probably a single for all I knew. And that's what we did if we didn't, you know, and mostly running back then. And didn't do the gym much, you know, maybe a little bit here and there. And then I skied some, but I don't remember hard. But we got all our kids into downhill skiing when they were younger because we weren't going to be hockey parents and we didn't have interest for soccer. They all ran cross country again, my wife's influence in high school. So,
what were your keys back? This is a selfish question because my kids are all young. What was your keys back then that you thought was like, hey, this is how I manage the work. This is how I manage, you know, being a father. This is how I'm like, what stood out to you, or what was things that you could point to? Like, I really prioritized this, or I was really good at this. Like,
well, I did work harder than maybe some people would, because there wasn't time to be able to go coaching.
Yeah.
And I wasn't there for the kids to bring them to all the events. But on the weekends and on, we spent time together. Either it was skiing or hiking. We hiked all the 46 peaks. Wow. We played games together. We did, you know, different activities and playing ball in the yard. So there had to be that balance for us, particularly as a couple, to get along to find a way through.
Yeah.
You know, here I am. I'm not just, you know, the absent father, you know, working, although Julie certainly took the brunt of the work, you know, when she was working, you know, a little bit less, or definitely less when, you know, the kids were born. And so, you know, for me, it was that, it was an everyday kind of strike the balance.
Yeah.
I certainly I do more work around the house and don't have any problem with it. You know, and you could look at it both ways, because I think there's that, more modern kind of situation for people to look at things like, you know, how do I exist and how do we get along as a couple? Because that was as important to our upbringing with our kids and how we did things together, plus how we existed together, plus what they saw together, plus doing anything with the children and being active with them was such a joy. You know, it was everything from bath time to, you know, skiing or doing something else outside or finding something to do with them was super. It was wonderful.
That's good, because we're similar to that. So
did that answer your question?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I look at it because it's like, obviously different parts of your life, like things are more at the forefront. Like right now, that's at the forefront. Like 10 years ago, I didn't have kids. I wasn't even thinking about that. You know, which is funny, because I'm like, back then I had all the time in the world. And I'm sure 10 years from now I'll have a different thing that's more pressing. But I think a lot of it's that. It's really like, I have family, I have work to support family, and then I have hobbies. So my thing was, let me cut out anything that's not super important. Some of it's people, some of it's hobbies, some of it's, like I said, I've cut out business opportunities because I was like, my priority was family. And, you know, and you manage around it. I'm way more efficient than I was back then, but you have to cut stuff. You can't do it all. So, but again, I just don't want to have the regret of not spending time with kids or my kids when they're young. So,
can't get it back.
Yeah. And like we said at the end, business is cool and all, but it's not as important. Now reading books.
Ah,
you said you're a reader. Is that something like, that's a little bit of a getaway for me. I'm not as much of an outdoors guy as you. I like some of those things, but I'm, you know, majority of those things I don't do. But like reading for me is one of the things that it gives me some escapism. I've recently got back into playing guitar. So like those two things where it's just quiet and I'm in the mode. Like I'm, and skiing's the same way. When you're at the top of the slopes coming down, you're thinking about skiing, which allows you to have a distraction of everything else because you're so focused. And same with guitar. And for me, reading's the same. I sometimes daydream when I read, but I do like just sitting down with a hard copy book and just getting like, even like 20 minutes just to read is relaxing.
Yeah, I'm reading a little less now than I used to, but I know putting that down there would help our discussion here today. So I also read books for work. Okay. And I will read books that help me, you know, increase my skills, increase my aptitude, and, you know, various different ways I'll listen to different discussion with an expert, and I will buy their book and read. And I have a bookshelf of, I don't know, 50, 60 books that I've done that with. Mm-hmm. But for a pleasure read right now, I'm reading the Vladimir Monk book by Julie Canepa.
Okay.
She came and spoke to the local Rotary Club I'm in. And so that's been an interesting read, and it's taken me kind of out of what I would normally read.
Is it fiction or is it a...
No, it's based on a real story, so it's historical fiction.
Okay.
But he was the person at the concentration camp. He was in Plattsburgh, and they did a documentary at the local PBS station here. So I'm finishing that up right now, and I've enjoyed that. It's totally different than what I would normally do. So in some occasions, I'll try to read the easy book about an author that I've read 25 books or something, and in other times, I'll read a book that I feel like I need to do for self-improvement.
But
sometimes I just fall asleep on my book, Alan, because I don't have enough time.
No,
or I haven't given myself enough time.
So you're more nonfiction?
Well, Yeah, I would say historically, you know, from my standpoint, I would tell you in the last year, I probably only read about, I don't know, 12, 13 books, mm-hmm. if that. Those were all pleasure reads.
Okay.
And at work, I don't know if I read two or three books for work last year. I have two or three that I need to get to right now.
So you read them at work? Like you'll try to a couple pages here and there?
I will, but that doesn't always work. I'll have to try to do it on a weekend when it's earlier in the morning and I can get through some of it, or it's sometimes not before bed. But yeah, I do enjoy reading but sometimes I'll read on my iPad. Or I'll read a hardcover, depending on which way it is. So, and being a member of the local public library is such a great advantage, being able to download books now.
Yeah.
Or the public library out of New York, because we're all New York State residents. So, to me, that gives me a break and calm time.
Like nonfiction books, do you ever take notes on them? Because like I write in all my books. Like all my books are pretty much, I say destroyed, but you can't sell them back.
I have and I haven't. I mean, I think we've done this at work. You know, we've read books like Critical Conversations, or, you know, and I've got a couple books like now I want to read something called About Magic Words, you know, about, you know, persuasive words to use that I think are powerful.
Yep.
But I'm always a little bit like, well, I might give this to somebody else, so I'm not writing it down. But to your point, though, to really utilize and have the memory of what you did and look back at it, it needs to be able to be highlighted or noted. And I maybe should do that with the next three I'm reading.
Well, 2022, I think, there was one year I was like, I'm going to set out to read 60 books.
I saw your notes.
Okay, so the only reason is because I read that the average CEO reads 60 books. I'm like, I can do that. So I ended up getting 60 something, and that was audible awesome. Too. So I listened.
Ah, great.
But what I found was the biggest benefit I had was I was exposed to a lot, even though they were mostly nonfiction. Yeah. Some were biographies. I was exposed to a lot of new ideas, which was great. But what I found was as I started the next year, I was like, I'm going to read the same amount. I started to get away from reading for a number. And I found I was starting to get pulled back to books that I read that I really enjoyed. And I started to flip through and reread or skim or read the notes. And what I ended up doing was instead of reading for volume, I started to read for quality. Uh-huh. So I found that my books, I'm not ripping through books as quick, but I read probably every day. But I might only read three, four pages. But I'm like, I'm almost studying the books, or I'm pulling out. You know, you read a nonfiction and it'll give you like action items, like go do this, this, and this. Most people are like, on to the next page. So I've really tried the people that I follow or the people that I really – or the authors that I really connect with or like their writing. I try to get it, and then it might lead to something online. And then I go into rabbit holes where I'm like studying what they're putting out versus reading a bunch more books. Because I have – I'm also in the I came across this a couple of years ago. Someone said you shouldn't have a budget for books. So I always look at there's a book I want to get, I just buy it.
Right.
And I oftentimes try to I don't – sometimes I'll put it on Audible if I feel like it's going to be a book where I'm like, I'd be better off just listening to this.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's someone that I know that I'm probably going to want to take notes, I usually buy the hard copy. My go-to is always used books. So I try to get a used book first because it's cheaper and I'd rather just get a used book.
Smart.
But I do. Sometimes I do get new books depending on what it is. But I think overall, I have a huge shelf of books that I want to get to. And some of the books are like, I'm like, I bought that a year ago. I've never opened it. But it still has an interest to me. But I've started to read for what, like, I want to say excites me at the moment. So instead of, like, sludging through a book because I feel like I have to get through it, if I don't like the book, I'll put it – I'm trying to get better at just stopping. And like, you don't have to finish the book because you started it. And then I also am like, you know what? I was on that book. I'm halfway through it. But this other book came out that I actually – this one kind of is giving me a rabbit hole to go down. And that book's more around that. And I'll stop that book and go to another book. So I'm not finishing as many books because I'm trying to kind of follow where my interest lies at that moment, which makes the reading more, a little bit more enjoyable because it's something that I'm like, that's like, you know, more top of mind or firing me up a little bit more than something where I'm like, I feel like I gotta read this book because it had good reviews, but I don't really gel with it. And I'm like, just stop it. Go to a book you like or reread something that you already enjoy.
I can't tell you everything I've taken away. I think when you read through it at the moment and you're like, wow, I think that does kind of supplant the back of your brain when you've read things. And if you're current, you're going to be able to find a way to use that the next day or the day after. Mm-hmm. And I mean, some of these books will take you out of your comfort zone. yep. and they'll make you think differently. And I think, you know, that's kind of a constant. You told me earlier you were a curious person that wanted to learn.
Yeah.
I mean, that drive to learn is going to keep you going. But I can understand if the book doesn't resonate necessarily, then you've got two or three going because your mind's going to go to something else that you want to, you know, see for entertainment. But when I typically delve into a book, like for work, you know, I'm going to get to the point where I'm like, okay, I still need to finish it. And I feel like that because I think otherwise it's going to bug me if I don't. And a lot of these authors, in some cases, you don't know what you're missing until you read the next part. So I want to read that next part.
I do get that FOMO a little bit. Like, if I quit this, I'm not going to get it. I'm going to kick myself because now I'm 75% of the way through and I stop. I've done it on a couple. There's a a little bit out of the bit, but you know Ray Dalio?
I don't, but go ahead.
Okay, so Ray Dalio, he's one of the biggest, like, largest hedge fund managers in history, and he wrote a book called Principles, which is, like, a pretty, like, at this point, a very acceptable business book that's probably, like, in the realm of, like, Think and Grow Rich. Like, it's probably, it's newer, but it's kind of in that genre now. So I read it, a lot of knowledge in there, a lot of brilliant stuff in there. I got halfway through it, I'm like, it is very dense. And also I got to the point where I'm like, this is cool, but it's almost like in a different span of where I am. So I stopped it and I have not finished it. And I don't plan on finishing it, but I think it's a book that I will come back to, flip through my notes about halfway, and then I will finish it at some point. But that was a perfect example of a book that had a lot of good reviews, but it just didn't hit me where I was in that point in time. And it's something where I've reread books years later, even a year later, and I'm just in a different mindset and it registers with me differently and it makes more sense. And so that's what I'm trying to find now of, like, what really sticks out. I always have a book in my book bag. I always have a book, you know, out at my house. I got a bookshelf in my room, which probably not the best spot for it, but that's where it's ended up. I just want to keep it away from the kids so that it doesn't get all you know, ruined. But that one, same thing. Like, I got to have my top shelf of books. It's like a liquor cabinet, but my top shelf is all my, like, my books I will go back to and reread.
For me, I think you could be anything and all above or everything what you want. I mean, you know, for instance, you know, it solves your problem for what you want at that moment, then that's great. And you don't have to finish it. For you and what you're driving at, you want to learn lots of different things.
Yeah.
I think that's great. To me, but these days, you're also, like, we're on a podcast right now. The thing that, you know, you're learning from too is you're learning from podcasts too.
Yeah.
So you have multiple ways that you're taking information in.
Yeah.
I mean, geez, you're very, very current in that. That's admirable. It's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, it's good. But like I said, there's some nights where you take in too much and you got to almost, like, start cutting out what you consume. Because you're like, I got to start, like, I did a purge of social media. Like, I started following less people because I wanted to follow, like, who was giving me value in the sense of information. And I wanted to cut through the fluff and kind of get to, like, what do I really want to see? And same thing with podcasts. Like, I unsubscribed from a bunch that I'm like, I really don't listen to that anymore. But like just today, I've listened to two different podcasts, one working out this morning and one just commuting in the car. And when I work, I usually put on, like, white noise with headsets and just kind of, like, it just lets me just kind of, it's quiet, allows me just to work. But yeah, like, I'm always listening either music or podcasts. Like, I'm a big,
now you're making me want to write notes on the next books I read, so I make sure I look back and refer to them.
Versus
worrying about somebody else is going to read it because they haven't, and then make sure I absorb the detail, right? And then, you know, but I typically will read one book at a time.
I'm usually one book. I'm typically one hardcover,
yep.
And then I'll have a book on Audible, but Audible I go in and out of. Like, sometimes I'm like, you know what, I'm going on very podcast heavy. Because I want the quick episode, the two-hour conversation with some expert on whatever, and just hear what they have to say in real time. And there's sometimes I'm like, you know what? I just want to plow through, like, 3, 4, 5 books right now. And I'll listen. I'll go on a 3-week Audible kick. And like I said, I usually listen to them on, like, 1.7 speed, and I get through them pretty fast. But you got to pick and choose. But like I said, the book I have right now, like, literally my book bag has, like, dog ears, they're flipped. I have writing in them. I have, like, sticky notes in it, and it's like, it literally looks like it's like a resource book like you'd see in college.
That's awesome.
I
agree with you, and I think from your standpoint, what you said, the first thing was you want to go down slow enough so you take the information in. You also don't want to go too fast so it feels like a burden.
Correct. Sometimes I'll actually listen to the book first and be like, that was good, I gotta buy it, and then I want to pick my notes in. I did that a couple times, so I have it on both. But like I said, it's not every book, but a lot of the books I do start to take notes in. Sometimes I don't even like the book. I'll take notes, and then I might just toss it aside because I'm like, eh, I didn't really get a lot out of it. So, Randy, you were at the – and again, I have two questions I want to ask you, but I want to – I'm going to ask you this one first, and then first one's travel, second one's hockey. So yeah. The first one, traveling. Do you still travel quite a bit or try to?
Yeah.
Is that something – again, over your, is this more, you know, with your wife? Was this with family? Is this just solo friends?
Well, it mostly got introduced. My mom was a study abroad advisor at Plattsburgh State. Okay. And my older sisters also were sent abroad. And my mom's sister was, I believe, sent abroad. So I went to England on a semester program in 1986. And and I think I remarked in there, my mom dropped me off at the airport in Montreal. In Dorval, and we got on the plane, and we were alerted that there was a bomb that was placed on the plane. And so this is January 1986, and 6 months earlier, there was an Air India flight that went from Montreal that was going to London or thereabouts, and it went across the Atlantic, and it crashed. To this day, they don't know exactly what happened.
Was that the one with Scotland?
No, that was different. That was Lockerbie.
Lockerbie.
That was the Pan Am flight that was bombed after Gaddafi.
There was a girl from Shazzy on that flight.
Yeah. So somebody in my apartment complex in Syracuse actually was on that, two people. But so out of Montreal, there was a flight 6 months earlier. They have no idea. It was an Air India flight. So so we were, my mom dropped me off at the airport, and it was wake-up time. Here's the real world, you know, take you all in a area and remove you all from the plane, and, you know, all the dogs go around, and they're checking you out and making sure that you're safe, you don't have any, you know, bomb stuff on you.
And you're only, like, 20 at the time?
You got it. Wow. So
no cell phones, like different country.
No, yeah. I eventually called my mom and scared the heck out of her. But I got back on the same plane because they checked it, and I figured if they weren't safe, then we're all in trouble because they checked it. You know, make sure there was nothing on it. There was people that had to go reroute to different parts of the world, but that got me exposed to a lot when I went and traveled over to London. I mean, it was got me exposed to terrorism in the first place. A lot more, you know, before 9/11, you get to see, you know, where an American Express office where I used to change money every once in a while got bombed. And you go to Paris and there's people walking around with Uzi machine guns on the metro back then. So it got you, I think it felt like such a different world. So, but that's just, you know, that was kind of grow up, you know, you want to go out and see things. And, but London was great. We traveled every other weekend through the semester and went to the continent, went to Ireland, went to Scotland, went to see Loch Ness, you know, for instance, on a 13-hour bus ride, travel around Europe for 6 weeks on a train, go to see Germany, France, Italy, Spain.
And that was encouraged definitely by your mom?
Oh, yes.
Like that was like, you guys are going to experience this?
Yeah. That's cool. Travel around some people, the other people who were in school. I mean, SUNY Plattsburgh, the state of New York has great program for exchange where people can take advantage. It was the same cost. Same tuition, same semester cost. You just had to get there.
Yeah. I think I never did a study abroad. I think both my sisters, they either did or they went over for like mini kind of work, schooling type things. But did you have a favorite place you went?
Would it have been
London?
Well, that's where I lived. And it was a lot of fun going, walking around London and, you know, eating doner kebabs and hanging out and having a pint and just walking around to the different areas like the Old Bailey or, you know, Westminster Abbey, you know, Tower of London. I mean,
Trafalgar Square.
Yeah. You go see, you know, the poet laureates, you know, people chit-chatting. But some of the best memories were watching the people that had street art in the London Tube. You know, the people that were really, really good at their craft and they just, you know, work for coins. You know, so, I mean, that was really neat. But all of London, it was great, but going to see so many different things was wonderful. You know, everything from Munich to Austria to Salzburg to, southern Spain to Rome to Venice to Florence. I mean, we got to see so, so much in such a short period of time. Switzerland, too.
Have you been back to Europe?
Yes.
Is that primarily where you like to go, is Europe?
Well, it's an easy way to get to from here. Yeah. Most of the time you can get here, you know, you can do Europe in a week without, you know, way too much trouble. So
it's, just, it's almost the same as going West Coast.
Right, right. I mean, you know, 6 hour flight, you know, more or less, unless you have to go further in the continent. Yes.
Like I've been to a couple places in Europe, but as a kid, I haven't been probably in 15 years, but I've always loved it. And like I said, it's just a different culture. It's old. That was one thing I remember seeing. The oldest place we probably were was in Italy, you know, kind of Rome and Pisa, and, you know, going down towards like the southern coast. And the, but like as you went through like Paris or Ireland or London, like they just, the architecture was different. So it was just kind of cool how you literally, it's like reading a history book. Because I mean, again, the U.S. is less than 300 years old. Like it's not an old country by, I mean, it's 250 years old, right? About 250. So when you look at it, like the U.S. is an infant compared to the rest of the world. So it's so cool when you'll see these buildings that are older than our country.
Well, one of the first things you realize when you go to, you've been in New York City, and of course I'm talking back to 1986. You go to London and say, there's no big buildings here. Wonder why? Because they got bombed during the war.
Yeah.
And you go to
never rebuilt them up.
Northern Germany, and you look at, and you're going around with a lady I traveled with, she was first generation. And they're going around to show you where it was all bombed and, northern Germany. So, yeah, I realized, you know, when you leave America and then you come back, you realize you have a lot to be thankful for. And you don't realize how good we have it. And we've never really seen anything like that, at least in modern times.
Yeah.
So, well, pretty cool.
I was just thinking, I'm like, yeah, you never really see, like, the skyline of a European country. Like you never, that's never really like a big thing. If you go like more like Asia, or if you go kind of like Middle East now, they have, you know, Dubai and some like wild buildings out there. But yeah, I never even thought about that. But like DC is low because I think it can't be higher than, was it the Capitol building's the highest point?
Oh, good point. Yeah.
So, but that same thing when you fly in, like if you fly into Reagan, like you can see the Capitol like, where as you fly in. The Capitol's not a huge building. You go to New York City, like you'd have to look at like, where is that on the map? You know, it's just a totally different place. Okay, Randy, last question I'm going to ask you, and I'll get you off the hook.
Okay.
You were at the Miracle on Ice.
Yes.
So you're the first person I've ever talked to that was actually there.
Yeah.
And I think you're the only person I know that was actually there. I'm sure there's other people. I just have not known that they were part of that. But you were sitting six seats behind
Jamie Farr. Klinger from MASH. It was he was right behind
the TV show MASH. Okay, because when you wrote that, I was like, what? I don't remember that name on the team. Okay, so
yeah, he was the person that dressed up in the women's clothes to try to get out of being in the army.
So. I actually kind of know because my mom watched a ton of MASH as a kid, so I understand. Yeah, I know the show. So sorry, I was like looking at them. Mine was not on the TV show. Okay, so U.S. hockey game. What's your memories of that?
It was amazing. I mean, surreal. When you're there and you never had a sense of, you know, such a being American and national, kind of aspect of everybody looking around was cheering for the same thing. And it's just unbelievable because you didn't expect it to happen. And when you were looking at it and you kind of watched it and you were looking at everybody's faces and seeing how it was occurring, it was just unbelievably, you know, you just kind of think back and still kind of be in awe. I mean, I was right at center ice too. That close to the rink. So, and I was there by myself. My dad was able to get one spare ticket from Ron Stafford that happened to be from his connection. And dad, we had an office up there so we could get the car in and out. So he dropped me off. He didn't have a ticket for himself. So I was there by myself too.
So, and he probably thought they're going to get blown away. Well, so here, just lost have fun.
10 to 3, you know, certain short period 2 weeks of time before. I don't think I'll be ever able to duplicate that. The amount of feeling about pride, about being an American, and about, you know, everybody being, you know, I mean, remember, we're back to that right now, but the Soviet era versus the American era, and it was the big red machine.
That was the height of the Cold War.
Yes. Yeah. And they were so good. So disciplined. I mean, a bunch of hockey, you know, kids and scrappers never expected to win. And you're just sitting there going, this is just too unbelievable. And you're looking around, everybody's looking at each other with this incredulous look, like, this really happening. This can't be true. And when you, you know, and just the elevation and escalation of emotions was just like to a crescendo. Each time was more and more as the game went along.
Yeah, because it was a weird game because it was like we kind of kept like falling behind, chipping back. So like they never like, and obviously caught up and won, but back, okay, so back then, this because it was tape delayed for people.
Right.
Like that, if you weren't at the game, you didn't see it until later that night. So you were probably like back home and told people about it before it even showed it live.
We were out in the street celebrating with people like Lynn Swann walking down the street. He used to play
for the Pittsburgh Steelers.
Yeah,
receiver.
And, you know, you see Jim Craig and, you know, people right out in the street, you know, with what, you know, right away afterwards. So I do remember those vivid memories being right outside the rink and people cheering and, you know, all that being, you know, go USA. I mean, that was unbelievable.
Well, I mean, just because things weren't as connective at that time. It wasn't like you opened up like social media and were checking it. So like at the moment, because I think Sports Illustrated called it the greatest sporting moment of all time. Like it gets
ranked number one still frequently.
And I don't think it's ever been beat. And I think like at the time, it was obviously a big deal, but I don't think like you're probably not thinking historically how big of a deal it is relative to all the other sporting events.
I'm a kid. I'm 15 thinking, well, this is pretty cool. I got to get another ticket. And we've been to a couple events at the Olympics and it's pretty cool. The Olympics are there. And so here I am just like, hey, you got an extra ticket. Go to the game. It'll be great. Well, you don't get to go to that. Okay. I'll be back and pick you up. I mean, it's
so wild.
And you're there by yourself and you're like, you know, because I didn't have somebody right next to me, I shared it with the whole crowd.
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking around at people's eyes and seeing what people are looking at, and they're looking at you the same way back. It's incredibly big. Looking at Jamie Farr and looking at him, too. You know, we're all looking at each other going, I didn't expect this. You know, this is too good to be true. And, I mean, there wasn't, you know, any Russian fans in that crowd. We were all Americans. All of us.
And it's not a huge stadium. So like,
it was 5,000 or so or whatever it was.
So I mean, it was packed, probably packed to the seams. And like, what was your most vivid memory of it? Was it that, just seeing the crowd's reaction?
Yes.
Like the actual gameplay, it's hockey. So like you might remember a goal and you might remember a couple of plays, but it's pretty fast and it kind of like, you know, blurs together. But
it was the people in the crowd. More than watching the game.
Yeah.
The feeling and the aura of being there, like you could have cut it with a knife. You could almost breathe it and smell it. It was kind of like, wow. If I think back to that moment and put myself in that spot, you're sitting there going, like, you know, this is, you know, unbelievable. And I'm like living it. I'm here. This is real.
And the thing with hockey's a sport that it's a quick sport. So you kind of get in that mode where there's timeouts, but nobody takes timeouts in hockey. You know, it's like you might have one at the very end of the game. But for the most part, it's like you're playing the whole time. It's kind of like soccer, but the difference is it's very quick. Basketball is quick, but basketball, you can stop the clock. You can foul. You have these moments where it's like football. Like there's these slower moments towards the end of the game. Hockey's not. The clock's just ticking and the puck's going around. And I never played hockey, but I love watching it. But like, in a moment like that, when everything's crazy and they're, you know, it's the speed of play, and obviously as it's getting closer to the end, the U.S. is like trying to hang on, and you can see the clock just ticking down, and like we've seen the clips, like you can just see the crowd like start to get louder as they get closer to the end of the game, like, oh my God, we're almost there, like, so I mean, is that what we see on the film from your memory the same?
Yeah,
probably more so
with the people actively holding their breath.
Yeah.
And then the gasp and elevation about things when they went right, you could almost count it on it happening or not, because we were all so intent watching. And it was amazing. I mean, your people that you were with just became your new best friends. Everybody, and there were people hugging that didn't know each other. It was just nuts. I mean, you were like there and you were like, I have no clue who you are, but we're here. We're all doing the same thing.
Did you know anybody else there personally?
No.
Yeah.
Zero.
I was going to say, if I had to pick one sporting event to go back and watch in person, if you could say Time Machine Go, that'd be it. I mean, I don't think there's another one you could pick that would have the same level.
Let me add up, too. I was at a hockey game before that, and it was really nothing to do with anything. So when I could tell you,
too. The Olympic game?
Yeah, okay. I was at the Olympics, too. I was at a Czechoslovakia, I think, a game that was made for consolation.
Okay.
It didn't really matter. it was like a flat game. There wasn't really any cheering. People were happy. No, they weren't really. It was just kind of like, ah, this is all right. Here we are at the hockey game. That I was with my father at that one. So here we go. Here we are at the next game. Oh, man, you know, 360 degrees different.
Yeah.
Here we are. You know, this is for all the marbles, and the USA got there. So
I one of the coolest sporting events I've ever been to live was the 2015 Women's World Cup semifinals. It was up in Montreal.
Mm-hmm.
And my, well, Gina, you know, Gina, yeah. And so big soccer fan. And we went up. We watched every U.S. I've watched every U.S. women's soccer game since I've been with Gina. We both like soccer, but we went up to Canada and they played Netherlands like a couple weeks prior. That was a blast because it was Canada. Yeah. It was in Canada. Yeah. But then you were kind of watching the bracket, and the U.S., who obviously were favored at the time, looked like they were obviously going to make it to probably the semifinals. The problem was, whether they played in Montreal or I think it was Vancouver, was based on like how teams ended up. So there was a chance they played in Montreal. There's a chance they played out in Vancouver, and our semifinal tickets were going to be the two other teams. I think it was Japan and whoever else. And so they ended up drawing, I think it was Germany in the semis, and it was 0-0. Same thing. We kind of were sitting. The crowd was nuts. We left 3 hours before the game to get up to the game. We arrived at the game 10 minutes into the game. There was a line at the border. There was a line at the bridge. There was a line in the park. There was a line just physically walking to your seats. I've never seen so many people going to a game, and they weren't like North Country people going. We ran into people from Boston, from New York City. Like all these people just kind of Philadelphia just coming up to this game. And I don't know how much you know about, but like Alex Morgan, she had to come. Okay, so Alex Morgan comes in. She gets tripped in the box, which is on our side. Draws a penalty. Carly Lloyd gets up, scores the penalty at the net we're at. So like, and you remember Montreal Stadium. So
yeah,
they were actually shooting towards the outfield. So the wall wasn't there at the time, but it was like kind of, if you remember the old Olympic Stadium. So we were like the right field bleachers that would have been. So they end up scoring right in front of us, and they held, it was late in the game, probably in the last 10 minutes, score, hold on, go to the finals. I think they won 5-0 against Japan. That was the coolest moment because, again, it was USA. So, like, that's the first time I've ever really been to, like, the President's Cup and stuff for golf. But to see a World Cup and to see it, like, in Montreal, them to win the way they did, that to me, right, is probably the best sporting event I've ever been to. But it had to do with the national team, which is, it's weird because national teams, like, it's different. It's a different level of competition. But when you start putting nationalism into, like, whatever the team is, you feel that much more passionate about it versus like your hometown team. Even though you do feel passionate about your hometown team, it's just like a different, because you come together.
We need Galen to go to a Premier League soccer match in Europe and go watch and see how they treat that game.
So. I know. And that's, I've never been to an EPL game. I can only imagine. I know people that have, and obviously you watch the games. And did you ever watch Ted Lasso?
I have. I didn't watch third season yet. It's a lot of fun.
Oh, I won't tell you. But the last season's great too. But when you start to see and obviously they're doing, you know, a fictional version of it, but like how the fans are in that, it's kind of funny. But it's so true. Like, I think they said the only thing close to what you would experience there would probably be like college sports, maybe college football, where someone's like, they're so tight to a team. And you see it at different levels. But I think when you get to the national team, it's like everybody kind of puts aside, like, why root for, you know, Philly or LA or Miami? And then they come together and like, oh, that's our one team. So it's cool.
We need to get 2026 tickets, Galen.
I know, LA. LA. Yeah, actually, my two big ones, President's Cup is in Montreal this year.
Yeah, we haven't seen the tickets yet.
I don't think so. And then Ryder Cup next year is in Bethpage Black, which is in Long Island, which is one I've never been to a Ryder Cup. I actually went the 07, 2007, they had the President's Cup in Montreal, and I went. I was in high school, which was fun. But it's not the Ryder Cup. Totally different. Randy, we're going to wrap it up there.
Yep. Sounds good.
Okay. Anything you want to say before you leave, or you want me to sign us right off?
Just want to make sure I thank my wife for everything she's ever done for me.
That's good. You might be the first person that said that, but I like that, Randy. All right. We're going to end there. Episode 262 of the Galen Trombley Show. We're out. Thank you for listening to the Galen Trombley Show. Be sure to subscribe, review, and share the episode. You can follow me on all social platforms at Galen Trombley. Thanks for listening.